Well, a week-long trip to see wildlife and maybe in a new place sounds like a pretty good adventure. What would you think about spending 7 months in a dozen countries experiencing all the amazing wildlife there is to see? Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and great to have back naturalist Bill Volkert. He and his wife Connie recently returned from this incredible journey. And as you can imagine, he has some amazing stories to tell, and we're going to talk with him about those stories. Bill, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Larry. It's great to be here.
I was, you know, looking at your schedule here. You traveled 37,000 miles by air.
Mm-hmm.
12,000 miles. You drove 12,000 miles.
Yes, we rented 5 different cars.
And then you were also on, you had buses and...
Oh, we had drivers and buses, cars, vans, all kinds of modes of transportation. We also went by little tuk-tuks, bicycle rickshaw, motorcycle rickshaw, rode in a zebu cart, which is some type of an ox cart that they use in Madagascar, elephant ride. Just about every possible means of transportation.
Dugout canoes, I think.
Yes, about a dozen different boats. So, we went in all kinds of means to get to all kinds of places.
And even whale watching at one point, weren't you?
Yes, off the south coast of Africa.
Wow. That's amazing. And you stayed in hotels and so forth? And
whatever was available for accommodations, whether it be a small bed and breakfast, a guest house, a hotel, a lodge, or in a reserve. We had 104 different accommodations that we stayed in. And we also camped for 20 nights in southern Africa.
Oh. And the goal was to see as many, especially birds. You were focusing a bit on them, but other wildlife as well.
Yeah, of course. To see particularly birds and any other wildlife in some of the great wild places that we could find.
Oh, man. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. You may have a question for Bill about the trip. I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post your questions or your comments there, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. And if you've had something, a similar experience or an experience away and away from home that was particularly meaningful to you in the way of birding or wildlife, I'd certainly love to hear that as well. So join in, 1-800-642-1234. Now, this had to take a lot of planning. You must have... When did you decide to do it? When did you first get the idea to do it, and how long did you plan?
Well, I guess my wife has had the idea of a round-the-world trip since probably high school. Hmm. We've talked about it over the years, and it's been kind of a casual topic of conversation for quite some time. But we both have recently retired, so we've got the time. Mm-hmm. We had just an opportunity to do it. And as we said, yeah, we're both in good health at this point.
Yep.
So you never know. I mean, if in 10 years we're still doing well, we'll add to it. We'll never do a trip like this again, not of this duration. But if not, we certainly wouldn't have any regrets. At least we did it. So, yeah, it took months. We spent, at least 6 months very seriously planning and organizing the trip. And the way we started was we got a world map, put it out on foam core and hung it on the wall.
Mm.
Stared at it for a while and just looked at it and tried to think as kind of a reality of, well, where would you really want to go? And then we got serious. We got the little stick-on tack notes,
mm-hmm.
like you use for bookmarkers, and I got 2 different colors. One bright red for must-see places, and then another color for, well, it might not be the primary destination, but if I'm in a neighborhood, it would be interesting to see. So we pasted these up for both of us all over the world. And, of course, there were way more sites than we could possibly see in any one trip or probably in a lifetime. And then we had to make a decision of, so what sort of a route do we take to connect as many interesting dots? And do we take a northern route or a southern route? So mm-hmm. there are places in Scandinavia, northern Europe, eastern Europe. Should we go up that way and around? Or do we do more of a southerly route? And we decided to leave in fall or late summer. So a northerly route was out of the question because by the time we get there, the birds are already migrating out. The weather's going to close in. You hang around too long, and it's just going to get closer toward late fall and winter weather. Also, there are places in South America we want to see, but it's really hard to get a flight to South America and then from there over to Africa.
Yeah.
So we thought, well, South America, those places, we'll go back some other time. So we decided with South Africa and, of course, India, we certainly wanted to see, and then make our way through Southeast Asia. And these were also places we've never been before that are incredibly rich in wildlife and wild areas. So a chance to see totally new places and totally new wildlife. So that was the first thing we did, was just to pick out a route. And then I printed up a calendar. We picked our beginning and ending dates. It was September 7th of last year. We headed out. And in fact, right after the Labor Day show I did with you. And we got back on April 23rd. And we decided about the third week of April, I wanted to be back and have my feet on the ground before our spring migration for May really got going. Mm-hmm. Didn't want to miss that. So those were sort of the boundaries we put on it. And then we had to see about flight times, what we could really get. And we cashed in all the frequent flyer miles we've ever accumulated in our lives. So that made it much more affordable. But we had to lock in then on those reservations. The next trick was to take a calendar and to allocate so much time for each country. And then to start to do the research. What were the best places to go? What are the real hot spots or the real gems? And how many days? I mean, I actually had a little formula that I used. And so the first one is your destination. Where are you going to go? Next one is duration. How long are you going to stay there?
Uh-huh.
Then you want to look at your transportation. How do you get there? And then your accommodation. Where are you going to stay? And finally, reservations. For whether it's transportation, for accommodation, for tours or guides or anything else you can arrange in advance. And that way I started filling in a calendar, more and more detail. And I also wanted to give at least 2 days at any place at the minimum, and really good spots, 3 and 4 days. Because you don't want to just be coming in the afternoon, quick walk around, have dinner, go to bed, one full day, go to bed, and the second day, and then you're up and gone. You'll wear yourself out in no time doing that. You want to pace it and enjoy it.
So... you and the 12 countries you were in were...
We first went to South Africa and then to Madagascar. Uh-huh. So from Johannesburg, went to Madagascar, then back across South Africa, drove across Zimbabwe. We rented a car for this part.
Yeah.
Across Zimbabwe, over to Botswana, through Namibia, back down through South Africa, all the way to Cape Town, along the southern coast in the garden route. And then circling around to Johannesburg. That was the first 3 months.
Oh, my goodness.
Then to India. We had 6 weeks there. And from India, we went to Goa on the coast and then the Western Ghat Mountains, which is a very rich area for endemic plant and animal life. Circled around there and then went to northern India out of Delhi and checked out the Corbett Tiger Reserve and down to, of course, Agra by the Taj Mahal and a few other reserves in that area, and then all the way to the far north in the foothills of the Himalayas. We returned to Delhi and then went to Kathmandu, and we went to southern Nepal at Chitwan National Park, and then back to Kathmandu and then to the north, and we did a 6-day trek in the Himalayas.
Man.
And then we came back and toured the city for a bit, and very sadly, we had a wonderful tour to be able to see Kathmandu, and I've seen pictures now of some ancient sites that we actually photographed and walked around, and now they're in ruins.
Oh, they're in ruins.
And I have written to people that we stayed with, and I haven't even heard back, so communication is down, and I'm not sure what is all going on there.
Oh, that's
so that's unfortunate. Then from there, Kathmandu to Bangkok, and we met a friend there. And so he could actually bring all my maps, books, and other things for the remainder of the trip. And we bought a suitcase, and he took everything else back. And I just paid the extra baggage fee and said, here, John, please do us a favor. We did 3 weeks in Thailand. And then after he departed, we went to Cambodia at Siem Reap to see Angkor Wat, which was amazing. Over to Vietnam, down to Malaysia on the peninsula. And then we finished in Borneo.
Wow. An experience. Bill Volkert, our guest today, naturalist, wildlife educator at Horican Marsh International Education Center, just returned from an around-the-world birding adventure lasting 7 months. Talking with him about that adventure, join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show if you have a question about his trip. Or maybe you've got an experience of your own to share on a trip you took. We'd certainly love to hear that as well. And again, the number 1-800-642-1234. Kim in Monroe's been waiting a bit. Kim, thank you for waiting. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Well, my trip was not quite as exotic, but we have some very wonderful wildlife here in the United States. And about 10 or 12 years ago, I was going through Wyoming, and at the time I had a sled dog team, and just three dogs I had with me. And I was driving my old dogmobile with my BMX bike on the back. And I would just stop and camp wherever, and I was on a dirt road on some rangeland, and I had hooked the dogs up to the BMX bike. And I was running along, and a herd of pronghorn antelope showed up. And, you know, they're real smart alecks. They know they're fast. So they would run up alongside the dogs, get ahead of me, and cross.
Uh-huh.
It was driving the dogs crazy. And then they'd come back, run up alongside of me, get ahead, and cross. Well, one of the times they were monkeying around doing this, they misjudged the distance, and they cut too close. And the dogs kicked into overdrive and closed the distance. And all of a sudden, I had pronghorn, and this was like about 20 of them, just bouncing around all around me, just in a panic, trying to go.
To get away. Wow.
Yeah, and the dogs stayed on the road. They didn't break their training, but they really enjoyed the chase.
Oh.
And so...
Well, that's a wonderful story. Thank you, Kim.
That's a nice intimate experience with wildlife.
And it opens up, and thanks for sharing that. It kind of opens up a question for me to you, Bill, about you had some experiences even with elephants and with not wild antelopes, but with lions and tigers as well.
Yes. Well, in India, we did a jeep safari in one of the reserves. We went to two different tiger reserves. And, we actually had a really nice view of tiger laying there, got up three different times, moved over, laid down again. And it was an open jeep, so we were quite exposed.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, it got up and bounded right across this little dirt road behind us. And incredible experience. That is a big cat.
They're
massive. And then probably the most thrilling, exciting, harrowing experience we had was in Africa at Kruger National Park. I'll take a minute just to share this because it was really one of the top ones. We had been driving the back roads of Kruger, and we met somebody who said there were some lions laying off in the edge of this road. So we drove over, took a look. There was a car or two there. You can't get out of your car, just like Yellowstone. I mean, people and animals don't always mix well, and here they'll eat you.
Yeah.
So... I saw them. They're just laying back and just resting in the heat of the day. It was starting to get warm in the late morning and couldn't really get the best view. They're under backs in tall grass. So, okay, those are lions. And well, we just left. Yeah. We turned around, went down, and we found a really nice roost of vultures, several species of vultures there. And as we're coming back on this road, here was this big herd of elephants. And it was almost 20 elephants, and he had three very small young with them, one in particular. And they're grazing along just off the road. We're like, wow, that's a really big herd. That was interesting. And as we passed them, I said, well, let's just take one more look at the lions. And we, sure enough, we drove up. They're laying on their backs in the grass. Nobody else was there. I got a few pictures, but they didn't pose very well. We then continued down this road to where it was a dead end. It came to a dry riverbed with about a 20, 30-foot drop-off down to the riverbed. And we pulled over under a large shade tree, decided to have a little bit of a snack and just relax after getting up very early that morning. And as we were sitting there, I hear this trumpeting of elephants. And I sat upright, I looked in the mirror, and I saw this lion bounding up the road, just like you'd see in a movie, coming right toward the car.
Oh, man.
And it's like, oh, my God, we got this lion coming. And all of a sudden, I realized our windows are wide open. So, quick, Connie, roll up the windows. And we just got the windows rolled up, and we turned around, and he stopped just right outside the car. I mean, he was within 12, 15 feet at the very most of the vehicle. Stood right there by the vehicle. I got a couple of shots through the back window and watched him walk right next to the car and then down this little hillside. A couple more pictures, and he disappeared into the brush. As the lion walked off, we were sitting back, going, wow, that was amazing. People will spend days just to even see a lion in the distance. We've got him standing right next to the vehicle. I said, how can you top that? And just about the time I said that, I happened to glance in the mirror, and I saw an entire line of elephants coming up the road toward us. And I realized what happened. They were grazing, moving along. with these very young, came across the two lions. And, of course, that's why they trumpeted and chased them around, chased them away because they had the vulnerable young. As I look back, here there were four across on the road, and I realized, hey, we're at a dead end, and they just blocked the only way out. So we're now pinned, and they just kept coming, and this herd of almost 20 of them came walking up almost behind the car. And the frightening thing about it was that we had just heard a day or two previously, they told us at the parks, careful of the big elephants. They've been known to roll cars. They said what had happened about 6 months prior, there were some Japanese tourists who didn't give way to a bull elephant, rolled the car over and stomped on it. And we had a tiny little car, this little Volkswagen Polo, and it seemed incredibly small next to these elephants. Well, they walked up, the matriarch of the herd came right behind the car, and I could just see her knees and trunk out the back window. And with this drop-off toward the riverbed, I wasn't sure which way they were going to go. And Connie said, so what do we do? I said, just don't move. Just
stay there.
Yeah, we have to wait for them to do something. And they shuffled around for at least 10 minutes. And it was a little unnerving. And finally, she found the same path the lion went down, but it was kind of steep. And that's the problem. Elephants can't go down a real steep incline. She finally made her way down, and one by one, they started following, and another 5 minutes went by. And all of a sudden, the entire herd was circling around to our left side. And as I look back, here were three young bulls, and they didn't like that. One of them came out, started swaying his trunk and flapping his ears, very agitated. And he just didn't like that little bit of room between me and that pathway.
Oh.
And so I was like, okay, we're just going to give this a try. Nobody panic. I turned on the engine. The elephants didn't move or anything. And what I did is I circled around slowly clockwise. And then
you got
they circled
away.
Around the other way to give them room to open it up. And we just kind of shuffled around each other. And finally, they walked. We drove out of there, and man, our hearts were pounding. Like, wow, that you couldn't top it for an experience. That was amazing.
Bill Volkert, our guest naturalist, retired wildlife educator at Horican Marsh International Education Center, talking about his around-the-world birding adventure. And we haven't talked about birding yet, but we'll do that next. Here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we visit with Bill Volkert about his around-the-world trip with his wife Connie as they saw something like 800 species of birds, among other things. And so we're talking with him. And certainly looking forward to hearing what you have to say as well. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to have you do that as well. Actually, if you've got some photos, post those. We had a nice photo of a bird from Josh on our Facebook page, as a matter of fact. There's a question from Josh. Were there specific birds that you really wanted to see, or were you more interested in going to specific places and then trying to view as many as you could?
Oh, good question. Yeah, certainly we wanted to go to just really rich and beautiful places and see the variety of birds. And, you know, I guess you get into an area and you just want to see whatever presents itself. But as we started studying the field guides and becoming familiar, they become target species. And there's always were a few that I really wanted to see. There were some that we were fortunate enough to get a good look at and got some nice pictures. And there are others that were just a little frustrating and never did find. But I think that's the nature of bird watching. You take what you can get, you set your goals high, and you see what you can actually accomplish and what you do encounter.
What did you use for camera and photography gear?
We had three different cameras. I take along Nikon SLR, single lens reflex with a larger lens, an 80 to 400 millimeter, and that's my wildlife lens. So for bird photography and for all the animals out there, that's what I use. And then I carry just a small little point and shoot just for the quick landscape snapshots fill in, only because I found that if I'm always changing lenses, I seem to have the wrong one on at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And, of course, the other problem is if it's a little bit windy, there's a much better chance of always getting dust inside the camera as you're switching lenses. And then we had one other camera as well with a real nice telephoto capability. And so we had three different cameras, and between the two of us, we just kept clicking away. I guess I tend to shoot a lot if an animal is going to sit still, because you just, you know, you never know what you're going to get, what's going to be a good picture. So if they're going to cooperate, there's nothing to shoot 50 or 100 pictures of an animal you'll never see again in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. Was there a particular bird species that, that met my wildest dreams?
Oh, there were a few of them out there, the hornbills, we saw quite a variety of hornbills. There were a number of endemic species, and what we mean by that are birds that are found in a very restricted area in the whole planet. Madagascar is certainly known for that, and that was amazing. I found 78 endemic species of birds there. They occur nowhere else but on Madagascar, and so we had a very nice variety. That was very satisfying. In Vietnam, there were some birds of extremely restricted range, just on one little mountaintop or hillside, a little plateau where they're found. We're able to encounter them. There were also some frustrations. We went three times back to a place where the ibisbill was supposed to be wintering in the rivers in northern India and Nepal. And the last day, we haven't had a guide, says, "I'll show it to you, guaranteed." I said, "Guaranteed." Now, I like that language. Never did find it.
Oh.
We arrived just as the sun was going down. He goes, "Oh, we should have been here a half hour earlier." Oh. And we had been there twice before. Could not find the ibisbill. And then the giant nuthatch. That was another target bird in northern Thailand. It's a very restricted range. And, oh, gosh, we tried for over 4 days to find giant nuthatch. And we went back to a place that everybody said, "Oh, it's easy to find." Yeah, every time I go there, I find it. I don't know. It eluded us. I had one fly over as a silhouette. I swear that was the giant nuthatch. I heard an unusual call that sounded kind of nuthatch-like. But I could not get 100% identifying view, and it flew right over our heads. So there were some near misses. But who can complain? We saw an awful lot of good stuff.
I already had a few people ask, how much does a trip like this cost? And it could be, I'm sure there's a huge range depending on how you're staying and what, you know, everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, we set a budget for each day. Mm-hmm. And my wife, she's the accountant. So Connie kept track of everything. And one nice thing, first of all, for traveling is around the world, it's either charge cards, more and more people are taking them, or if it's cash only, you can usually hit an ATM somewhere. So that worked out that way, so you didn't have to carry so much money, actual cash on you. Overall, she tries to add up the trip, and she's, "Do you know how much this cost?" I said, "I don't care. I had a great time. I don't want to hear it." But it came to a little over $40,000.
Yeah.
We had some investment money that we transferred over. I said, "Look, I'm not saving all that just for a nursing home." Connie's mother had passed away just a few years ago and left a little money. She says, "You know, I think my mom wanted me to travel on this." And we just took basically our life savings and said, "This is a once-in-a-lifetime chance." So we didn't do too bad for 233 days.
That's pretty good.
I think with all air travel and all transportation, food, everything, it was something like $180 a day. And that includes the flying there. So we kept
pretty good.
Pretty well, I guess, yeah.
Caller Joe in Wausau wondered, what kind of safety precautions should you prepare for when going on a world trip like this? And were there dangers you encountered that you didn't expect? Of course, we talked about the elephants, but so what about safety precautions, and then what about dangers you may have encountered?
That's a great question. First of all, I can say from this trip and other travel that we've done in foreign countries around the world, most people are absolutely wonderful. They're fascinated to see foreigners. They're great hosts. They really want to show you around. And 99%+ of all the people out there are just going to be incredible to deal with. There's always a bit of a caution, and I remember my mother used to always say, "Oh, you be careful on the trips because it can be dangerous." I go, "Huh, look, Mom, it's dangerous in Milwaukee. You know, it's the wrong place, the wrong time."
Sure.
You know, any of our bigger cities, there are places you need to be cautious. So I feel that most crime is crime of opportunity. So my rule of thumb, don't give anyone an opportunity. Don't leave things lay around. Don't just take your eyes off of stuff. Pack very light. We each had just a small carry-on suitcase, a day pack, and a camera. That was all we went with. If you look at the pictures, you'll see both of us wearing the same shirt half of the trip because we had two shirts along.
Yeah.
I had two long sleeves, two short sleeves. That's it.
Yeah.
So pack very light. And the other thing, I always carry my camera bag with me. I want to make sure it's with me because that's the safest place. Unless I'm in a crowd in a big city, then I leave it in the hotel locked up. I lock the bags. And then what I did is I took along a bicycle chain, a cable.
Mm-hmm.
And most of it's snatch and grab.
Yeah.
Don't let them do that. I take the bicycle lock. I ran it through the handles of all the suitcases and sometimes around a chair. Well, you look pretty funny walking away with all that. I've always said, look, I may appear to be paranoid, but I'd rather look paranoid than vulnerable or gullible. So it was sometimes a bit of a hassle. You get it all locked up. I forgot something in the suitcase. Now I got to take it all apart, open it all up. Well, I just feel more comfortable if I'm sitting down for a meal. And I actually had that happen once. It's like, oh, geez, I left my camera sitting on the bed in the room. It's a very small place, very quiet. There's only a couple other guests, but I just did not feel 100% comfortable without it, knowing where it is. And so you want to be able to relax. So those are some simple precautions. As far as real problems, no. We had no significant problems, no loss of items. People were just wonderful. They were really great. And I think the only real problem we had, two countries, Zimbabwe and Cambodia. We kind of rushed out of there. Zimbabwe is just broken. ATMs don't work. Nobody uses charge card. It's cash only, and you can't get cash. So we were running out of money.
Yeah.
And we got up to Victoria Falls. Well, that's a big tourist site. So at least we could then charge a few things. And at the end, I had $12 left on me. And I quick swung into a parking spot so my wife could run into a little gift shop. She grabbed the last 10 to walk in, look for some small gifts and things. And the police came over and said, you know, that was an illegal turn. Well, the police there will scam any tourist. I had to quick chase her down and get the last 10 bucks to give the police for this scam of a so-called illegal turn. So we went broke there and had to cross the border just to get money and so we could carry on. And then the other problem was food poisoning. We're usually pretty cautious with food, but you can never tell. We got sick on three different occasions in three different countries.
We had a Facebook question from Dean who says, I'm traveling to Fiji and Western Samoa this year.
Oh, fun.
What species should I seek out?
Well, the Pacific Islands have a number of endemic birds, and particularly some of the pigeons, which to us pigeons don't sound that interesting, but fruit pigeons have populated a number of these islands, as well as some of the other songbirds and rails. And because these are such isolated areas, you'll find that a lot of these islands have their own little collection of endemic species. I haven't been to either of those, but my best hint would be pick up a really good field guide to the birds of those areas. What I would do is go on to the American Birding Association website. Their bookstore is Beautio Books.
Beautio Books.
Yeah, Beautio, which is the genus of the red-tailed hawk and other soaring hawks.
Yep.
Just go there and search under field guides and look for Australasia and Pacific and see what's available, who's published what. And that's what we had to do for this trip. I had 20 books that we took along, which were bird identification guides, also books of where to watch birds in particular countries where they were available.
Yeah.
And then a couple of the Lonely Planet books. We got a lot of them as e-books. Just to lighten the load, too.
Yeah, oh, sure. So thanks for that comment, Dean. Another Facebook comment from Marilyn. We just got back from the Galapagos cruise on a 90-passenger ship. Our expectations were exceeded the first day with sea lions on the beach and Sally Lightfoot crabs. Every day brought a new adventure with marine iguanas, island iguanas, lava lizards, green sea turtles, and the giant tortoises. And the birds, frigate birds, blue-footed boobies, diving for fish, Nazca boobies?
Yes.
Flamingos, swallowtail gulls, penguins, albatross, finches, mockingbirds, pelicans, cormorants, to name a few.
Yes. That's a very rich area for its bird life, and of course made famous with Darwin, where he recognized that the finches were unique to each of the different groups of islands. And again, it's an island situation, so the birds that made it out there a long time ago have now essentially been specialized so much, they're unique species. And so, that's a great place to be able to see a lot of interesting wildlife and a number of endemics.
You can join in, too, with your questions or comments or experiences to share. Love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. Love to hear from you. Someone wondered, what were some of the biggest environmental challenges that you saw on the trip? And you know, some, hopefully, were they being addressed?
Oh, good question. I think that every country has its own environmental challenges. South Africa is fairly good economy, a very large land mass, and they've set a lot of land aside for the animals. Kruger National Park alone is just amazing. It's 200 miles long.
Yeah.
And you can't really, say, camp or stay outside the park and drive in during the day. It's just too big. So they have what they call camps in there, and they're actually villages. The problem there is, even in a place that's that heavily visited and trafficked, we were seeing information that in the past year, 840 rhinoceros had already been poached in that park alone for the illegal trade. And we were told that the going price for a rhino horn now is $220,000. They've got such an outrageous price on their head that people are willing to risk everything. And, yeah, there's a tremendous amount of pressure, even in countries that are making great strides to protect wildlife. Madagascar, the problem there is it's an island, and I think it ranks among the five poorest countries in the world. It is way down there in terms of its poverty, a huge population of people with a very poor standard of living. And the unfortunate thing is you've got such pressure on the forests, the wet forests on the east, and you have the dry, spiny forest in the west side. And it's just so many people on so little bit of land, and so many endemic species. The lemurs that are known there, we saw several species of lemurs, and just the forests themselves in general are getting compressed. And it's really sad because there's just so much wildlife that's found nowhere else. India has its own host of problems, 1.3 billion people. Their reserves are spectacular. They're really quite nice what they've set aside, but there's an awful lot of people. And we have seen the smaller slums, ghettos, or barrios in Central and South America. And so we're used to seeing, say, those poorer sides of town and the shanty towns. And even for everything we've seen, and when we rolled out on the train out of Delhi, our jaws were dropping. We have never seen such rampant poverty, and it went on, not just a neighborhood. It was miles and miles. It's just a sea of people and a lot of pressure there, and it's a real challenge. Vietnam was another one where you've got a relatively small country, 95 million people, and what was shocking for us is the complete lack of wildlife. You could just drive we had drivers taking us from one reserve to another across country and hardly see a single bird. And you would expect if there were flooded rice paddies, right, that there should be egrets and herons out there. There should be shorebirds here. When we went to the Haiphong to take the harbor tour around the islands, Connie commented and said, you know, there aren't even any gulls here. And it just seemed to be empty. And I get this feeling they're eating everything. So you've got a really a large population of people with a tremendous pressure on the land. And unlike India, where most of them are actually on a vegetarian diet and they'll leave the animals alone, here it's all food. Yeah. And one of the unfortunate things is the very first national park ever established in Vietnam, Ca Tien, where we went outside of Ho Chi Minh City. You would think this is a premier site, would get top priority and protection. 2010, they shot the very last rhino in the country in that park.
Uh-huh.
So if you can't protect wildlife there, where do you? And the many pheasant species that are found in Asia, the great Argus, people are collecting it for its feathers, and it's just a chicken dinner for some. And so you've got a number of critically endangered species with a lot of people who, you know, they just need to eat. And it's getting to be a pressing situation.
Were there any environmental success stories that saw that maybe gave you some hope?
Well, again, in India, for that many people and a modest-sized country, there are some huge reserves, and they are very well protected. The tiger populations, a number of these are actually increasing. That's quite well protected, and I thought very impressive for the country. In southern Nepal, Chitwan National Park is the home for the Asian one-horned rhino. They were doing a really nice job there. It was spectacular, and oh gosh, over 400 species of birds, or almost 500 known to that park.
Wow.
It's really quite a sight, and for a very poor country, they really set aside a large piece of land and have done a nice job of protecting it and actually expanding forests around it to connect as corridors to other surrounding protected sites.
Very.
Some good stories.
Some good stories out there. Ray and Rhinelander, thank you for calling. Hi.
Well, thank you. And once again, thank you, Larry. You're wonderful. And you always have nice, cool things on that are informational. And the guest you have on obviously did their homework with a lot of things. I want to tell you an experience I had in the early 70s. I was fortunate enough to go up the Amazon River all the way up to the mouth. I was there for 3 months. How I was able to go there is a friend of mine worked for a major pharmaceutical company. At that time, they were looking at alternative natural types of things to, you know, develop drugs from. So I got to go up through that whole area before they started the deforestation and, you know, basically wrecking the region with for cattle and, you know, and cutting trees and everything. But what's interesting is all the wildlife I saw, it was amazing, you know, and we always had guides with us and stuff, because when you're going through these areas, these really wild areas, you got to know what you're doing or have somebody with you. You get off the beaten path, and everything in the jungle is there to consume you, literally. So I would a word of caution to people, if you're going to travel in these remote areas, make sure you do your homework and be with somebody who knows the terrain. But I saw some amazing wildlife. It would take me an hour to just go through it, but it was just an amazing experience. So I just wanted to pass that on.
Thanks a lot for calling, and some pretty good advice there from Ray as well.
Yes, definitely. You don't go blindly into places like that. The rewards and experiences can be just an experience of a lifetime, but you want to be prepared. And as he mentioned, yes, if you go with somebody who can show you the way, it'll certainly help you to give a good feeling for what you need to watch for and be cautious. And the local guides, they know where the wildlife is and have eyes and ears for things that you would walk right past. So that's always rewarding, certainly.
Pat and DePere, hello.
Hello. I'd like to ask your guest a question about the Galapagos Islands. I'm taking my two sons there in June. We're doing a six-day cruise of the Western Islands.
Good for
and
you.
Then we're going to be spending a week on Santa Cruz. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what your guests would say would be the must-see islands that you can do a day trip from Santa Cruz.
Well, I might be the wrong person to ask. I've been to Ecuador twice. The Galapagos belong to Ecuador, but I've never been to the Galapagos.
Oh!
It's kind of like coming it's like coming to the United States and not getting to Hawaii. So
yeah.
I mean, it's within the territory.
I heard you talking about the Darwin and all that, and I thought you were talking about the Galapagos.
Yeah, no, somebody else had an experience there. Again, I think some good research. That is a very well-explored area. There's a lot of wonderful tours. And there's more than enough resource out there. So, yeah, just to poke around a little bit to see what is offered on the different islands and what's going to satisfy your interest. I'll tell you one thing that I did for preparing for our trip is because this was really a birding trip for us, I went to the websites of the large bird companies, tour companies around the world. And those include Rock Jumper Tours, which are out of South Africa, Wings and Field Guide Tours out of North America, also Vent, Victor Emmanuel, and then out of England, Sunbird Tours. These guys go all over the world.
Yeah.
And if there's a country that's got birds, they go there. So what I did is I checked their itineraries. And if, say, for planning for a trip to Vietnam, if you see that three of the companies are all going to the same three reserves, you know those are the hot spots.
Those
are the
best
places. Must-see places, and that's what I did, is I kind of hacked those off of their sites and planned and got some great information from it. And I would suggest that, too, or take a look at any of those resources that are out there and see what you can find and what's going to satisfy your interest.
Thanks very much, Pat, for calling. Appreciate your call. Bill Volkert, our guest today, naturalist, retired wildlife educator at Horican Marsh International Education Center, just returned from an around-the-world birding adventure. And as we've heard, an amazing adventure. Larry Mueller here. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, visiting today with Bill Volkert. and talking about his around-the-world trip, but also we're going to talk about birds right here in the United States and in Wisconsin as well. So I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've got an experience to share, an exotic place that you saw some wonderful birds. Call us, 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. Peggy called from Chicago, Bill, and wondered what kind of immunizations are needed for a trip like this.
Oh, good question. Over the years, we've had hepatitis A and B, typhus, typhoid, the whole series of normal, I guess, travel-type things. We needed to update our yellow fever certification.
Yeah.
And we were... suggested for the Japanese encephalitis. One nice thing is that these records are now all computerized, because after a while, I can't even remember what I've got or what cycle they're on. Some are once for a lifetime. They want to know if you've ever had it. Some of them are good for 3 years, 6 years, 10 years. So, you know, you can't keep track after a while what your latest update is. But if you go to the Center for Disease Control and also the U.S. State Department and just take a look for any of the countries, they'll tell you what immunizations are required or recommended for any place, and then you can check with your doctor.
We had a Facebook question from David who says, closer to home, is it possible to see whooping cranes in the wild in Wisconsin? If so, where and when?
Right now, and Nisida National Wildlife Refuge, and also they're releasing them at Horicon. Those are the two best places. But they're becoming a little bit shyer now at this time of year because the adults are nesting. So they're going to be a little more reclusive. And also, as the cattails and other vegetation's growing, a place like Horicon, they move back more than a few hundred yards, and even a big bird like that can be lost from sight. It's hit and miss at this time of year, but they are out there. A better time would be as we get into mid-late summer and fall. The young will be growing up, the birds will start moving around more, and they'll even start flying with the young as we get into late summer, and that makes them much more visible if they're actually moving around.
Yeah.
But you can poke around at Nisida or Horicon. I've saw Hooper whooping crane twice now at Horicon, including the birdathon that I did for the Natural Resources Foundation about a week ago. So those are some of the best places to just try your luck, see what happens.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good tip. Was it kind of fun to get back, actually? How did it feel to come back after? So, I mean, were you really sad to come back? Or?
Well, first of all, we were sitting back in Borneo toward the latter part of the trip, and I remember Connie just saying, you know, I could just keep doing this. It was a very relaxed pace, and we got very comfortable with just traveling, and there was no homesickness.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you just moved from room to room, we always stayed for a couple of days. Coming back, well, even my house looked strange in the neighborhood, and I do remember with the jet lag, I would get up at like 1 o'clock in the morning. I just knew I couldn't sleep. I'd get up, I'd go on a computer, work for a few hours till I got tired again. I'd lay back down and get up. So that happened the first 3 days or so. And at one point, it was mid-afternoon. I thought, I just need to rest. And I laid back on the couch. I didn't want to completely sleep because I wanted to try to get enough sleep for the night. And I dozed off and I woke up and all of a sudden I'm looking around going, oh my God, what room am I in? What country?
Where am I?
Where am I? And I realized, oh, that's my living room. Okay.
I'm home.
Yeah. But otherwise, you know, we did this bird watching every day, and I just continued. We got back here just in time as spring migration began. I never put the binoculars away, and I went right back out as soon as I got here and started watching warblers and orioles.
And so, and here they come.
Continues. Yeah.
And was it, and frankly, just how is the... is it pretty normal, the migration that you've seen so far this year here?
I could tell when we arrived in that third week of April that we were behind schedule. April, I heard the early part of it was cool, so the birds were sort of held back.
Yeah.
Then there was a little bit of a rush, and then it cooled down again in the early part of May, held back the birds, and then they seemed to rush through. Right around the middle of the month, we had a really nice flurry. And I think they felt like they were getting a little behind schedule. The next couple of south winds just took them out. And it was a pretty narrow window of spring migration for a real peak.
Ruth in Altoona, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Hi. I'm going to take you back a little bit in conversation here to when you were talking about Vietnam.
Yes.
and the lack of wildlife, birds in particular, is your topic. So, and you said, well, we figured that people were eating them. But I would anticipate that the Vietnam War had a huge impact on the livelihood of different species, and that there's a huge recovery probably from that maybe now is out of balance. And in general, the impact of war, I mean, we just don't always think about the consequences of war, but you did this trip around the world. I would think that, you know, in various parts of the world where there's conflict, that we are losing all kinds of wonderful creatures. So
probably losing a lot of habitat,
like you to comment.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. And so if you could comment on what you know about that.
Sure.
Just because I think there's a lack of awareness of that impact as well.
Yeah. Thanks, Ruth. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, Larry, you're correct. It's really the impact on the habitat. In Vietnam, of course, the problem was it is a very much covered in jungle or rainforest, which made it difficult to find the enemies. And so we used a lot of defoliant.
Yeah.
And that was really the impact on the habitat, both by defoliating the forests as well as possible long-term contamination of the residual of those chemicals. As far as the upheaval, just like any sort of unrest, sometimes when you disrupt society, well, now you scatter people from farmland and from reliable food sources, so then it becomes that bushmeat. So oftentimes that now is a food source they start to resort to. Sometimes there are some other consequences, which, for example, in North Korea, you've got the demilitarized zone. Well, this has been 50 years or more, 60 years now, that there has been this stalemate. And it turns out it's the only reserve they have on the peninsula.
Oh.
Nobody goes there. So they've left it alone. So that has actually given them a break, where you've got a very aggressive economy in the south and a lot of wetland filling and destruction of the habitat that remains, just because a lot of people on a small peninsula. And with that, it's the one place they've kind of left alone. But yeah, that upheaval certainly makes it difficult, not only in terms of, say, the sustainability of the habitat, but also the conservation efforts. You know, the conservationists are the first ones, as far as international workers, who pick up and leave. And now everything is just kind of thrown in the air. And so, it really adds into the mix another more complicating factor.
Talking with Bill Volkert, naturalist, wildlife expert extraordinaire, wildlife educator at Horican Marsh International Education Center. It's great to have him along as we talk about his trip and also about birds not only around the world but right here in Wisconsin as well. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. What about the number of, how many life birds did you?
Oh, that's a great question. I kept track of daily bird watching, so I would keep a little notebook in my pocket. And on one page, I'd always keep our itinerary, which I kept a journal from. Then at night, I would type. And I would write down all the birds we saw each day. And as I would always carry an identification book with me and try to learn as I went. And in the end, we ended up with 1,355 species of birds that we saw. And over 1,052 of those were life species. In other words, birds I've never seen before. Now, that number got pared down a little bit. And that's simply because not everybody agrees that some of these forms that I saw are yet accepted species. Some people still consider them to be a subspecies or a population of something else. So I use a computer program for all my bird records. It's the only way I can keep track of it anymore. And the program I use, Birder's Diary, relies on the Clements list of the birds of the world. That's the one that Cornell maintains.
Yeah.
So some of these, what we call splits, species that have, where you see a variation among the species in one area and another, some people have split it and say, well, we really think those probably are two species. The experts that I have ran into and the books that I used in some of these countries are not yet accepted splits in this country. So the list now is down to actually 1,328 species that we saw. But I footnoted the others, so in case they should ever become elevated to a true species, I might kind of gain sighting, so to speak. But it was over 1,300 species of birds.
Wow.
1,025 were totally new for us. And we also shot 35,000 pictures.
So you've got the rest of your you got a lot of work to just organize those.
I'll spend more time sorting through pictures than I did doing the travel, I think.
Oh my goodness me, I would bet. Glenn in Fox Lake, hi.
Hi. I have a mutual friend of Jack over in Beaver Dam.
Oh, sure.
And 2 years ago, we put up a nest box for osprey.
Mm-hmm.
And last year, we had our first fledglings.
Yeah.
Yes, I heard about that.
They are back up again this year.
They should have young in the nest by now. And in fact, there's been a pair over near where I live. And 2 days ago, I could hear them calling overhead. And they had just fledged the young, and I could see the adults circling overhead and the two young flapping away madly with their first kind of maiden voyage there and just taking to the air. So yeah, they're already out of the nest for some of them.
Yeah. But, and then we have, this is our golf course in Fox Lake.
Mm-hmm.
We have a couple pair of sandhill cranes that just have young ones, and we get to watch them all summer until they begin to fly.
Oh, man.
I
have to take a break to take a look at the news and weather and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. And then, Glenn, we'll come back and we'll talk some more about those birds. You stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A lot of different ways to experience a new country. You can eat the food there. I love to do that. Another is to visit the cultural and historic monuments. Bill Volkert and his wife observed the birds and other wildlife in their natural setting in their round-the-world trip. So we've been talking with him today on the show about that, but also zeroing in more in the later part of the show about Wisconsin birds as well. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions, comments, or experiences to share. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post your questions, comments, or photos there. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Glenn, as we were breaking for news, Glenn in Fox Lake had some comments about ospreys.
Well, like I mentioned, we fledged two last year, and now we've got the pair again, and they're sitting on young, I believe. We saw our first 18 wood ducks hatched a couple of days ago, so that's coming around. And I spend a lot of time in a turkey blind, and my friend and I up in Marinette County, Wednesday, my friend saw a male bear. And then Thursday morning, I was going out, and there was a sow and two cubs in the field. So, I mean, if you spend enough time out in the woods, you really see a lot of great things.
Absolutely.
Oh, you're absolutely right about that. I was just thinking about my own experience. This last week, I was playing a little golf at a tournament in Saskatchewan and in Waska Sioux in the provincial park there. So there were elk and a black bear and lots of deer and some whiskey jacks, some birds that are always fun for me to see. They're kind of cool. They're cool looking birds, mm-hmm. black and white. And they're, and so you're absolutely right. You have to be outside to see it, Glenn. Appreciate your call and your comments. And ospreys, yeah, they're here. We got them.
Yes, and they're doing fairly well in Wisconsin to repopulate a number of areas, and the platform projects by putting up the nesting structures have been fairly successful. So it's nice that people can actually help those birds, and a few places even have cameras on them. I was up at Woodland Dunes teaching a workshop, and they've got a camera right up there on the nest of ospreys. So it's fun to watch the progress.
Thanks, Glenn. I really appreciate the call. I want to give Tom in Janesville a chance to join us. Tom, it's your turn. Hi, Tom.
Well, hello on this nice rainy spring day.
Yeah.
I've been a coon hunter for, I don't know, 40 years or so, and so I'm out at night a lot, you know, in the wee hours in the woods and fields. And I, in the 70s and 80s and early 90s, we heard screech owls every place we hunted across the southern part of the state. Their screech owls were everywhere, and quite a few barred owls. But for the last maybe 15 years or more, I have not heard or seen a single screech owl and very few barred owls. And I wonder if you can shed any light on that. Are they disappearing? Is there a problem with them, or am I just not in the right places?
I don't think that for barred owl that there's any significant decline. Might be more of a local phenomenon for you. Screech owls, I think for them, it's more that with the success of some of the bigger owls, the great horned and barred owl, they're pushing them out because they will eat the smaller owls. And so there's a little bit of a hierarchy when you get the larger owls in. Screech owls either move out or become very secretive. We are working on the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas project. That is getting kicked off again, and that'll give us a lot of information on the distribution and success of nesting birds around the state. And since this is a second go-around, we'll have a chance to actually compare from what we did almost 20 years ago. So as that project goes along, we'll get a much more refined picture of just what's happening to different birds and where in the state. But I think perhaps it's more of a local phenomenon from where you are. I don't think it's a statewide concern for those species.
Well, that's good to know. There are a lot more great horned owls, it seems, so maybe that's the problem.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. This may be an appropriate time to mention the Wisconsin Birdathon, Bill.
Yes, I've helped them out the past couple of years, and it is a bit of an undergoing in springtime, where groups of people are out to see as many birds as they can during a single day at the peak of migration. I was out on the 17th of May, and I went around Horicon Marsh. I had 134 species for the day. Not a record, but certainly not a bad day.
Yeah.
And since I confined my travel to more or less, well, one property, and I added a few as I, on my way home, I made a stop or two and picked up a few species as long as I was underway. But the period for the Birdathon actually goes till June 15th. And if anyone's interested in donating, you can do it online. And just to prove that you actually were listening, if you are going to donate, if you go onto their website, which is WisconsinWIBirdathon.org, go to WisconsinBirdathon.org and go to donate and just click on Bill Volkert.
There you go.
Money all goes to the same fund anyhow, but at least they'll know that it was probably a result of the people listening to the show.
Oh, that's a great idea. Yes. So WisconsinBirdathon.org.
Yes.
All right.
And also, I make a quick mention, if anybody is interested in doing a little bird travel, I did this once before, and I'm going to try it one more time. My wife and I will be leading a bird-watching tour to Nicaragua next year, February 14th to the 23rd, with a five-day extension into the rainforest beyond that. And I put together a book, Where to Watch Birds in Nicaragua. I've been helping them down there with their conservation and education projects. And if anybody's interested, you can just go to my website, BillVolkert.com, and connect with me there.
Had some interesting times in Nicaragua myself many years back, especially over on the east side of the country.
Yes.
Puerto Cabezas area.
Oh,
and
sure.
And the and then in the jungles with the Mosquito Indians. Some really, so we could probably share some experiences.
Oh, yes.
Tell
yeah.
some stories about our times there. It was really a lot of fun for me. We had somebody wondered if you were going to write a book, by the way, on your trip.
Oh, I don't know. I've had a few people ask about it. I don't know if there's that great of interest of reading it. I mentioned before, I do keep a journal, but it's more of a log just for myself so I can keep track of what we did on what day and where we were. So that certainly wouldn't be interesting reading, but I did type up 285 pages of a log of our trip. But I do have other materials, the emails I sent back from some of our experiences and things. I could kind of pull some of that together and use at least as a basis. I do have other writing projects in mind, however. I wouldn't want to spend an awful lot of time on all of this and find that nobody really is that interested in reading it. I don't know.
Well, maybe there's some magazine stories. There might be some magazine stories or even some blogs.
Yeah, right now, we've barely been back 3.5 weeks. I've still got to kind of regroup, get caught up with other things before I take on any other challenge. Perhaps I will. I'm always open, certainly, to do presentations. And as invitations come up around the state, I'd probably be taking some sort of a... AV presentation on the road, do some presentations and talks as I've done on other topics, but those are by invitation as people ask.
And you're probably not ready yet to do
no,
that.
No, give me a while. With 35,000 pictures, I can't put anything together by the end of next week. So, but as we get into fall or winter, if somebody has a program somewhere and might be interested in something like this, certainly I could probably have something together by that time. And I'm certainly interested in sharing more about the trip and to illustrate it.
Well, Gary and Wynn, we turn to you next. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Larry. Great show. I live northwest of the George W. Meade Wildlife Area.
Oh, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Central Wisconsin.
And that's a fantastic place. About a month ago, we were down there walking dike off of Smoky Hill Road, and we saw this bright white object amongst these sandhill cranes, and as we got within about 200 yards, it was a whooping crane, which was just really awesome. And then so we did a big loop and came around the different way, and so we got a little bit better angle. Got some great photos of it with its mouth open, yapping and throwing its wings.
Oh, good for you.
So some friends were visiting this weekend, and we went down there on this past Sunday, and we got to see it, another whooping crane off of a different dike, but the other one didn't take flight, but this one did. Mm-hmm. And if you want to have an awe-inspiring moment, when those big wings come out with the black ends.
Yeah, and that is just a massive bird, isn't it?
It is huge and so cool. And the Meade is such a great place. We saw osprey, eagle, different kinds of heron, sandhills, a whole bunch of different ducks, geese. I mean, it's just a great place. But Wisconsin's really blessed with some nice places. And we also go to the Nisida Wildlife Refuge and then the sandhill just north of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're within an area of, within a half hour or so, we can be at one of these nice refuges, and it's just cool to see these fantastic birds.
Well, it's nice that you're both within easy reach of those sites, and you're taking advantage of it. That's the big thing. Get out there, especially this time of year, and enjoy it and see it. And those are what you're seeing. Those single birds are probably the non-breeders. It takes them a few years before they're ever old enough to actually start nesting. So birds from the Nisida area are probably spreading out, looking for somewhere else before they will eventually mature and settle down to raise their own young.
Sure. A couple of years ago, we were down at Nisida, and I think we saw five different ones that day. And then we stopped. They have a very nice visitor center there.
Yes, they do.
And the people were very well-educated and informed, and they were explaining different things. So we're really lucky in Wisconsin to have these things.
I would agree with that, Gary. Thank you so much for calling. And as I think it's others have called when you've been on the show, saying that they've seen a hooper, in past years, I'm thinking now, amidst a bunch of sandhills.
Just tower over them, don't they?
Yeah.
Sandhill is a pretty big bird to begin with, but when you get a whooping crane next to it, you realize just how large they are.
And taking off, there's something to see, but landing, I think it's even cooler to see them land.
Oh, it's a big bird. It's a lot of bird to come down and try to make a graceful landing, and they do it so well.
Oh, it's an amazing sight. Penny in Green Lake, your turn. Hi, Penny.
Hi. I had a question. I did call a local birder with this question. My middle son, who lives in Neshkoro, it seems like a ruffed grouse has befriended him. Whenever he goes outside, if he's by his ranger and going through the woods, the ruffed grouse will come with him. He's gone within about 6 inches of this bird. It's come into his shed that he has, and it's happened over, a period of several weeks. And the birder I did ask about was Tom Schultz in Green Lake.
Sure.
He said that he also heard of this happening to a guy in Fond du Lac. Is there anything known about why only ruffed grouse do this.
I wonder if this isn't a bit of imprinting that...
it's an adult bird, though.
Okay.
You know, it's an adult, and, you know, he never saw the bird's nest or eggs or anything. So I thought that, too, originally, but... I don't know, and Tom said it was the same with this guy in Fond du Lac. It's the same thing.
That it didn't have human
to.
Contact as a young, but somehow became habituated as an older.
Yeah,
bird.
I've had a few other stories. There was a fellow who would, when he mowed his lawn, the grouse would come and land on his shoulder and ride on the lawnmower with him.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And there was another one with some lumberjacks where they had a grouse, another story someone told on the air about a grouse that would come and, like,
and I've seen something similar of somebody with a grouse following right around the backyard.
Yeah, very strange.
Yeah. Yes. And it does seem to be it's the grouse that seemed to be doing that. I don't know why.
Yeah, usually you would think of it as young birds because they it would imprint to be able to follow the mother all through that summer and into fall before they disperse. For some reason, became a little more habituated with people.
Yeah, pretty cool.
Yeah.
Thanks, Benny.
Well, thanks anyway.
Yeah, sure. Thanks a lot for calling. We only speculate on that. We don't know. Marilyn and Mequon, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Connie.
Hi.
Bill, I was wondering when and where you're planning to make a presentation of your Around the World trip, because I would love to attend.
Yeah. At this point, I haven't made any plans. As Larry says, even if I got an invitation right now, I'd have to put it off for a while, so I have some time to really think of how do I pare this down so you don't take 8 hours to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, besides what's the story, find the right pictures, or more than that, leave all the others out.
Yeah.
And... but right now, I don't have any commitments, but, you know, I speak around the state, and as invitations come up from a number of different groups, they usually do their own advertisement. So if it's something's in your neighborhood.
We can always post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Even if you're not, if you're here, we can certainly talk about it. But if you've got some things coming up, just let us know, and we'll post it on our Facebook page.
Yeah, but usually I don't say aggressively advertise, and I'm not looking for... taking it on the road, but as you know, I've done enough talks for groups, and as it comes up that they've got a need, invitations open up, and we'll work it into a calendar as we can. So
we'll there you go, happens. Marilyn.
Okay, thanks so
see
much.
See if something happens in your neighborhood.
Yep, hopefully it will. How would you, going back to your trip, how would you characterize the birding in Namibia? Mm-hmm. Bill, Bob, and Mary in La Crosse are considering a trip there this year.
We really enjoyed Namibia. It's a lot of desert. So you've got the western edge of the Kalahari Desert and also the Namib Desert. It is a big open area, and it can get quite hot. Go during their winter months. So remember, they've got the opposite seasons. It can get oppressively hot down there. We actually know some people in Windhoek, the capital. We stayed with them for 2 nights, and... after we left, they said it was starting to heat up 40 degrees Celsius, which is 105.
Yeah, 105.
We went to Etosha National Park. Even when we were there, it was hot, but start first thing in the morning, it was spectacular. I've never seen so many giraffes all in one place. That is a wonderful place. There's something just really interesting. It's a very wild area. It's a wonderful country. I think there's a lot of great places.
All right.
Fish River Canyon, by the way, another must-see place way in the south. It's like a Grand Canyon.
Oh, perfect.
Yes.
So there you go. Bob and Mary, have a good time in Namibia.
Yes.
Bob and Franklin, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the show. We have some land in Monroe County, and we saw a bird that looks like a red-winged blackbird in a hayfield. They seem to fly around and walk all over the place.
Okay.
But the patches on the wings are white, and then it's got a off-white patch on the back of the head.
Oh, you're looking at a bobolink.
Bobolink.
Oh, that's a bobolink.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yes.
Yeah.
I looked in my bird book, and I didn't see it in there.
Yeah.
So.
Look up bobolink.
Yes.
Yeah.
You got a very good description of it. Thank you. Made it easy.
Yeah,
there you go. Yeah.
There you go.
And a very long-distance migrant because they will go all the way to the Pampas of Argentina, to the grasslands there.
Wow.
So it's a very long flight for them. And it's always nice to see them out in Wisconsin in springtime.
And Bob, thanks again for calling.
Yeah, you made it easy. Good
Tim, Tim in Delafield, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hey, again, guys, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I really enjoyed the show. I'm not a birder by any means, but I do love the flying animals flying around. And all the talk of foreign birds and stuff. That's really cool, but it just makes me think of my parents who, I don't live in Dolphield, I grew up there. Mm-hmm. They had, I think about 8 years ago, green herons roost in their yard. And in the evergreens, you know, they got a good clump of those.
They may actually be nesting there. They usually look for some really dense cover as a place to hide the nest.
Yeah, and they do a good job of that. Mm-hmm. And after a year or two of coming, they'd have babies, and there'd be about four or five of them waddling around awkwardly right in the lawn, and, you know, great. Their little bodies.
Oh, nice show. Yeah, you bet. Yeah, they're fairly adaptable for herons, and will nest sometimes a little bit of a distance from water. They seem to be a little more flexible in their habits than, say, the bigger great blue herons.
Great blue.
So, yeah, they nest in people's backyards occasionally and along the edges of lakes. Yeah. And
we've tried to feed them with crayfish in a dishpan, but they never went for that.
Usually small fish is their main food, and occasionally some of the large insects even. But they'll sit there and just stalk for the fish to come by.
Yeah. Thanks, Tim. Great experience.
Yeah, that's fun.
I'd love to hear about that. We have, I want to go back to the Wisconsin Birdathon again, Bill, and have you mention, for those who people might have missed it earlier, you were involved in the Birdathon, and talk about how people can help out there.
Yes, it's a way of raising money for the Natural Resources Foundation, and this is the support group for a number of different projects for bird conservation in Wisconsin. So they're helping raise money for the Whooping Crane Reintroduction Project, the Kirtland's Warbler Project, which is a federally endangered species that is now nesting in Wisconsin, the bird monitoring programs, the Wisconsin Stopover Initiative, which was the workshop that I helped with in Woodland Dunes, the Breeding Bird Atlas, Bird City, a number of these are projects that they fund. So the Birdathon is one of those fundraisers, and it is still ongoing for some people. Others, they've already finished their counts, but they'll certainly accept money even after the fact. So you're going to their website, wisconsinbirds.org, and you'll see the donate button on there if you'd like to support any of those projects. That's the vehicle to do so. And you can even specify any of those particular projects you want to help out with.
Yeah, and you're on there, and they can kind of contribute in your honor. So,
well, I wish somebody would, because I got back so late. I was a little disorganized this spring to get myself together. I promised to raise a little more money than I actually did at this point. So if you could help me out and help them out, that'd be great.
All right, there we go. And the other thing I just wanted to mention in the last 40 seconds or so, you are going to Nicaragua, and again, that's an interesting trip, it sounds like.
Yes, it's a bird watching trip, and that'll be February next year, the 14th to the 23rd. And if people just contact me at through my website, billvolkert.com. I'm just starting to organize that trip as well. I've got most of the information together from down there, and most of our reservations are set. So, we'll be ready to accept people to come along and do some bird watching with us in Central America.
And BillVolkert.com is probably, if you're going to be speaking, too, you're likely to have something.
Yes, I've got a calendar, and that's the information will be on there as well, you bet.
Bill, it had to have been a wonderful experience. Thank you so much for taking time to share it with us. I appreciate it very much.
My pleasure, Larry. And as I came back from this trip, my motto nowadays is one life, one planet, and so many birds.
Bill Volkert, naturalist, retired wildlife educator at Horick and Marsh International Education Center. Great to have him along. He'll be back. We'll talk with him again about birds. And tomorrow we'll talk with the folks from the Wisconsin Energy Institute about biogas. And then at 11:45, our weather guys stop by to talk about recent snowfalls in Wisconsin. Larry Mueller here. Stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network.